Good evening, everybody. It took me till after the last week's class to realize what kind of tzaddikim you are. They let me go through the whole shiur without telling me that I was doing the wrong topic. So I was supposed to do Megillas Esther last week and continue with Shmuel Bet this week. So I know it's not timely anymore, but I would like to. I really did prepare. Quite a bit of material, and I just mamish walked in from Mariv, so I'm just going to wait another minute. I just have to get one thing, and I'll be right back. Okay, thank you for waiting. All right, so any shiur on Megillas Esther really ought to begin with a Gemara that asks, Esther min haTorah minayin? Where do we have a reference to Esther in the Torah? First of all, to even ask such a question requires a question. You don't see a Gemara that asks Yirmiyahu min haTorah minayin, or Yeshayahu min haTorah minayin, or David min haTorah minayin. What do we have? Why should we care to have hints to these stories inside the Torah? So to answer that question, first of all, is that Esther's canonicity was very, very much questioned. Rabbis did not feel that there's any particular religious message in the story. There's been lots of cases in our history where at the last minute we avoided a tragedy. And I've just fielded a question on this in one of my messages last week. Because I do believe that when Esther said, Leich kenosis kol ha'yehudim, gather all the Jews and fast, That's tshuva. Fasting is tshuva. No, and the Rambam says that there's a strong connection. So the Jews were repenting. They felt bad that they became more Persian than Jews, and this was their way. Sometimes it's the enemy that has to remind us that we're all in this together and we're Jews.
Right? It is a little bit strange because Mordechai told her that she would not be safe if she doesn't take part in saving the Jews, you see, in the palace. It doesn't look that she was from the very beginning very much interested
he has to convince her miyodeim kais higata l'malchus for this reason. And you know, she gets on with it. He says that we're going to be saved. It's just up to you to determine whether you're going to have a hand in it. So look, the names Esther and Mordechai, well, they're nice Jewish names today. They are Persian names. In fact, they're names of Persian gods. It seems that the heroes of this story should have been someplace else, right? And they should have been someplace else at the end of the story. I'm talking about Israel. So that's really the Esther min haTorah minayin, and the answer is, V'anochi haster astir panay mikem bayom ahu. I will hide my face from you on that day. And most commentaries, like Ibn Ezra in his introduction to Esther, most commentaries claim that the essence of how Megillat Esther is found in that pasuk is that God's name is hidden. So God is hiding from us in this story. However, I've long ago shared with you the idea that the actual point of this Gemara is that the main message of the story of Esther is hidden from Megillas Esther, because the real story is what's going on, or actually what's not going on in Israel. And for that, I have to turn to a few points. To start with, why does the first pasuk say, "Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh, hu Achashverosh hamolech mehodu ve'akush"? Just say, "Vayhi b'mei Achashverosh hamolech mehodu ve'akush." Right? Because if it was the days of Achashverosh, he's the Achashverosh that ruled. Right? What is that? So it means that there is more than one of them. Right? So there were a few kings of the Persians named Artaxerxes and two kings named Xerxes. There are different opinions amongst the commentaries and the scholars which one is Achashverosh. Especially at the end of the Megillah, he's called Chashrash. The very last time he's mentioned, Chashrash, which looks like Xerxes. And if it says Hamoleich mehoduva ad kush, Hamoleich implies that He made himself king. He crowned himself king. Okay, Xerxes the First was not chosen king by his father. He killed his brother to become king. And if Ahasuerus assumed the throne by killing someone else, we understand that he would forever be paranoid that someone would want to do the same thing to him. In fact, there is part of the story says just that, with Bigson Vaseresh. So we'll see how Esther uses that to her advantage later on, knowing Ahasuerus's paranoia. Another thing is that there is a king named Ahasuerus in Sefer Ezra, Sefer Daniel, that has a son named Darius. Okay, he has a son named Darius. And Xerxes does have a son named Darius. There are two Darius. Darii? There's two kings named Darius in Tanakh. One is the king in chapter 5 of Daniel who conquers Belshazzar and throws Daniel in a den of lions when found to be praying to God. But this is a later Darius. And the third book where Ahasuerus' name appears is Ezra chapter 4, where Ahasuerus is convinced to put a stop to the rebuilding and refurbishing of the temple. Herein lies the political intrigue that makes up the main message, or the hidden message, I should say, of Megillas Esther. And I say it's not on what's going on in Persia, it's what's going on in Israel. And the oldest canard of antisemitism raises its head in this book, just as it does today. Because Haman in this book is called Sorer HaYehudim, and that's precisely the name of a group that appears in Ezra and Nehemiah, slightly off. It says Sorer Yehuda, the enemy of the Jews, and the enemies of the Jews, and their main purpose was to put an end to the favored treatment that the Jews were getting, as they did in this famous Cyrus Cylinder. You know, Cyrus allowed a whole series of nations to return to their ancestral lands from which they were exiled by the Babylonians. Right? But the Jews got some preferential treatment. In Tanakh, it says that Cyrus supplied the Jews with all manner of necessities to rebuild the temple. The other countries just got to go back home to do it. Cyrus, perhaps, I mean, Chazal say, because he knew that there was a prophecy in chapter 45 of Yeshayahu predicting long before his time that a king with his name would be doing just this. So he saw it as a type of oracle that he had to fulfill. Right? So he supplied us with wood, with animals, with oil, with salt, with stones and precious stones and all of the raw materials to rebuild the temple. And of course, whenever Jews get preferential treatment, you know, it makes anybody else, you know, the Jews worked hard for this. They worked on Cyrus and they, you know, they, okay. But beyond that, these people didn't say they were against Jews per se. They were against Jews who they felt were more interested in Israel than in Persia. So it's like the people today who say, I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm just anti-Zionist, right? So that's the new anti-Semitism today, is to place your hatred against those bad Jews, right? So they should wake up and see that even like Amnesty International or any of these organizations and these real anti they have to say they're anti-Semitic, because when the world gets into a tizzy over every little response of Israel to its the terrorism in its midst, and yet it doesn't make anyone near a geschrei when things 100 times as bad happen in many other places in the world, that has to be anti-Semitic. No two questions about it, right? And the fact is, when they say, no, it's just the bad Jews in the West Bank, it's nonsense. People who make these claims feel that Jews don't have a place anywhere in Israel. So I'm just saying this, but getting political for the moment, is that the people in Israel convincing Ahasuerus to rescind the previous orders allowing Jews to rebuild, that's really where this book is going. Right? And this is how Perek Aleph works its way through. It says in Ahasuerus' third year, he made this party in Shushan HaBira with great ostentation. Now, Chazal, I must say this is quite anachronistic, by saying that Ahasuerus was 20 or so years before the 70-year exile was over, it's a bit anachronistic. Certainly not Xerxes or Artaxerxes. That would have to be before Cyrus. So it's very difficult to say that. I think what the Gemara means to say is that the precisely what I've said all along is that the main point of this book has to do with the Jews who are, or rather aren't, returning to Israel to rebuild the Second Temple and to start the Second Commonwealth. So you see that the reference to Shushan HaBira, for instance, in Pasuk Beis, only one other city in the whole Tanakh is called Bira, and that's Yerushalayim. The third year of Ahasuerus' reign, the Gemara says, coincides with what he felt was the 70th year of the exile, and the Jews weren't returning. So he's making a party to celebrate the fact that the Jews are remaining in the exile. That, I submit to you, does reveal a certain type of truth, that the Jews felt more at home in Persia than they did in returning to Israel is patently obvious, and history repeats itself many times. Right? So the Jews felt so comfortable in Shushan that they called it the Bira, like Yerushalayim. And the Pasuk Gimel refers to five different types of officials, Chel, Paras, and Madaya, Partumim, Misurei HaMedinos. And Pasuk Dalet refers to six different types of ostentation, Osher, Kvod, Malchuso, Yekor, Tiferes, Gedula, So. And for how long, says the Pasuk, 180 days. And the Gemara makes an amazing drash. Whether the Gemara was mechavin to what I'm about to tell you, I can't tell because the Gemara doesn't say this explicitly, but I'm telling it to you now. It says in the Gemara that for each of these officials, five of them, they were shown six different types of ostentation per day for 180 days, which means that there were 30 different types of vessels or these different types of objects of beauty that were shown for 180 days. 30 times 180 is 5,400. And in Ezra, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Aleph, amazingly, it says that 5,400 vessels of the temple were returned by Cyrus to the Jews. Okay. This is where Chazal say that since these words, you hear them, Yikor, Tiferes, Chur, Karpas, Utcheles, Bechavle Butz, Va'argamon, Bahat, Bashesh, right? Amudei Shesh, Mitos, Zahav, Chesef. Right, these are words that appear very rarely in the Bible, and practically all of them appear in some context in Sefer Shmos or Sefer Melachim with respect to the building of the Mishkan or the Beis Hamikdash. No wonder why Chazal say that the Ahasuerus dressed up as the Kohen Gadol in order to gloat over the fact that the Jews are my captives, kibayachol, and they're stuck here. Not because I have a gun to their head. No. I'm finding out that the best way to defeat the Jews is to throw them parties and let them feel Persian. That's the best way. So that's why the famous memra in the Gemara, Shalu Talmidav Esrav Shimon Bar Yochai, Mipnei Ma, what did the Jews do that they deserved the Haman's decree? So the answer is, not that just that they felt they had to attend because, all right, the king is throwing a party, we should be part of it. No, they enjoyed the Sa'uda that was celebrating their defeat over not returning to Israel. Right? Now, with all fairness, there's a reason for that, because with the assassination of Gedaliah, and even before that, with the siege that the Babylonians had to lay on Jerusalem for a year and a half because the Jews refused to listen to Yirmiyahu, who told them to surrender again and again and again. He said, if you surrender, the Babylonians will put you to confiscatory tribute and possibly even slavery, but you'll live. They won't destroy your homes. They won't destroy the temple. They won't kill the king. Just let them come in. Let them rule over the land. That's not an easy thing to do. Right? The Torah character tells us we should let Iran come in also and they'll deal nicely with us. Right? So it's not a great bargain, but if you're a prophet and you happen to know that we will soon outlast these Babylonians and another nation will come in, which will be much more kindly disposed towards us, and we will be able to return to the land without a conquest like in the time of Yoshua or in 1948, we will be invited to return to the land by enlightened kings will be kindly disposed towards us. That's a good bargain, but B'nai Yisrael weren't ready to take it. So the fact that the Jews didn't remain in Israel all that time, for goodness sakes, even the Jews, even the 10 tribes that were exiled by the Assyrians would have returned if the conditions were better. But as it has it, life got so good for the Jews in Persia and was pretty bad, very bad for the Jews in Israel, for the few that remained. Even after they killed Gedaliah, they forcibly took Yirmiyahu to Egypt. And that was it. Forget it. No one was there to keep Israel running. Right? So the first 8 psukim of this book tell us a plethora of background material to learn that the main story is really not about the Jews Persia, but it's about the question of whether the Jews are returning to Israel or not. So it is about the Jews of Persia because that's where they're staying. Why weren't Mordechai and Esther at least in Israel, for goodness sakes? Right? That's where we belonged at this time. Yechezkel, it's the Haftorah of this Shabbos. It's the Haftorah of Parshas Parah. Yechezkel speaks in the Haftorah of this Shabbos as if though a Jew would have to be insane to live outside of Israel at a time where we can live there. No Jew would want to. You're only living in the exile because someone chained you to a slave ship and carried you off into exile. The first chance we'll get to return, we will. Well, not exactly. Okay? Yirmiyahu depicts the return to Israel as a bride encircling her groom. The keva to sovev gover. A woman will encircle the man. The reason why we do that at a wedding, we replicate that at a wedding, is because every wedding, Yirmiyahu says in that chapter, is like a return to the geula. Because earlier in the book, he said no one's going to want to get married because of the exile, and it's going to be so bad. But od yishama, so when people hear again the voice of the chasna and the kala, So we replicate this event at a wedding. But the Malbim explains that actually Nekevot Tesovev Gover means that the feminine, something feminine, will try to bring in the masculine in some way. And the Malbim explains that the feminine is the land. Eretz is a feminine word. Masculine describes B'nai Yisrael. So the land will beckon you. The land will ask you, will encircle you and say, come and return to the land. And it'll beckon you and you won't have to come back with a conquest. The land will be yours just to inhabit the way the Persians invited us back in. Okay? So that's the beginning of the story. We are enjoying this party, which is meant to gloat at our defeat, and that is laying the groundwork of Haman's decree. But because God always gives us the refuah before the makkah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu always puts in the chance for some kind of a survival element. So it tells us a story about how Esther becomes queen. And it involves Vashti Hamalka. You see, Gam Vashti Hamalka says some Mishtei Noshim. So she is also making a party for women. And Achashverosh wants Vashti Hamalka to show off her beauty. That's boorish. What kind of king does that? Right? You're so proud of yourself that you got a beautiful woman. What's that? Right? So when she refuses Achashverosh's call for her to show off her beauty, Pasuk Yud Beis, look how it's written. After it says, Gam Vashti Hamalka, Lahavias Vashti Hamalka, it says, Vatima Ein Hamalka Vashti. In Pasuk Yud Beis, the queen Vashti objected. She refused. And why does she refuse? Because I'm not some kind of an object for your friends to oogle at. As I'll, you know, sweeten the discussion about that it was all with promiscuity and whatnot, but still, pshat is pshat. She refuses because this is not the way a king acts.
Rabbi, is there a reason why Vashti Malka and Hamalka Vashti switched in the same paragraph? Is there any?
Absolutely, because he's telling her you're only Vashti, the queen, because you're married to me, and she says, "What are you talking about? I'm Hamalka Vashti." Because Vashti is a Kasti name. It's a Babylonian name.
Right.
Chazal say that she's Nebuchadnezzar's granddaughter. And even if you know, but it stands to reason from the following. Babylon was a highly cultured society. They invented, they created, they made wonders of the ancient world. They didn't only destroy, they also built. The Persians were boorish. Persians were better soldiers at this time, but they just wanted to drink. You see the way Achashverosh behaves. It's a parody, kiviyachol. But this is the way Persians act. And we know this. The Persians were boors. They were churls. As opposed to the Babylonians, as I said, who were much more cultured. So it stands to reason that the Babylonian men were wiped out. Right, wiped out in the battles that changed the whole landscape of the power structure of the ancient world. And the women, you know, the women are not combatants. So after a war, you know, they said, remember in Russia there was like a certain age that just didn't exist in Russia in the 20s and 30s. Right, they were just practically everyone that age was wiped out in World War I and then later in World War II. So there are a lot more Babylonian women than men. And it also stands to reason that beautiful Babylonian women were taken by the Persian men. And if you have these very cultured, very intelligent women living with these boorish Homer Simpsons, then there's probably going to be some kind of tension in the households, right? I suspect that some of the older people listening here right now to me remember the honeymooners, right? So if you have to constantly remind your wife that I'm the king of this castle, you're just a private, I'm the general, you know, he does that pretty often in the show. So, but everyone watching knows who's the real boss in that family, right? So, but when you have to make a decree, Lios Kol Ish Sorer Bebeiso Moshel B'chol, right? It's a parody. It's a joke. It's a power struggle between the old order and the new order. And Achashverosh is saying, listen, Vashti, your side lost. Don't try to beat them. You got to join them, right? And this is what we do. We show off our wives. And she doesn't want any part of it. So it's Vatzimain Hamalka Vashti. You know, I'm royalty before you, right? Now, especially it could have gotten snarky if she told him, you know, you aren't even chosen to be king. You're only king because you managed to kill someone else. But, you know, those who live by the sword either die by the sword or are always afraid of the sword. Sometimes being constantly afraid of the sword is the same as dying by the sword. So Ahasuerus manages to have some kind of a connection to people until that fateful plot on his life takes place. Because he doesn't sneeze in chapter 1 or 2 without a focused meeting with 7 or 8 people, and they're listed. And this told the people, right? What should I do about this situation? What should I do about that situation? Right? But once after the plot on his life, he only deals with one person. He wants one trusted man, and his name is Haman. Now, Esther knows this. Esther knows all about this tension between the men and the women. And she realizes she has to become the anti-Vashti. She has to look at everything that Vashti was. Now, she may have been Ahasuerus' wife before he killed his brother. Right? He killed his brother only 3 years ago. It's very likely that they were married from before. Right? And you know how these things work in these societies. You know, you kill the person ahead of you, and you always got to look behind you, right? So Esther is she's taken in to be queen. And what happens here is a fascinating thing. To a standard deviation that's very significant. And you probably remember this from your composition classes. Your teacher taught you speak in the passive voice with a minimum. Do not write your sentences passively. Or to be put another way, sentences shouldn't be written in the passive voice. No, I mean, don't write your sentences in a passive voice, right? So there's a passive tense in Hebrew called nifal, pu'al, or hofal. Nifal, pu'al, hofal. Megillas Esther has, by a standard deviation, well above 5, meaning that perek per perek, passive verbs per perek, is that Megillat Esther stands out well beyond any other book of Tanakh. And on the average of the whole Tanakh, more than 5 times as many passive verbs as the next in line. Why is this happening so much? Right? You can hear the words, uvihi kovetz yinosein lo, maye yosebo, uvihi kovetz naros rabots, bihi shomad var hamelech, isher nigzar oleho, v'nikro'o b'shem, v'tilokach ester, It's rare because the Bible is like your composition teacher. The Bible does not like passive verbs like this to such an extent. And what I'm suggesting to you is that it's the Megillas Esther's way of telling us how passive the Jews have become in determining their history. Haggai and Zechariah both gave such significant prophecies about the incredible opportunities facing them to make Bayis Sheni even better than Bayis Rishon. And look, but the times of Bayis Rishon was no picnic for the kings. The kings of Yehuda, right, here and there you had some good kings, but the northern tribes was almost all bad kings, practically every one of them. The whole enterprise of the northern tribes was faulty because they were worshiping at Bamos and serving God at 2 shrines in Dun and Beit El with calves in them. So the whole enterprise was sinful, right? But in Bayis Sheni, and especially, if I may quote Haggai, where he says, Od ma'at v'anim mar'ish es ha'aretz, in a short time I'm going to make such a ra'ash, such an upheaval. And Abarbanel says that that's a reference to Alexander the Great, who you have an opportunity to influence him. And indeed, there are Greek sources as well as Gemara sources about Alexander the Great bowing to the Kohen Gadol of Shimon HaTzadik, and about Alexander the Great being very kindly disposed towards us, and he certainly was a lover of wisdom. Right? That's what philosophy means. And what Bravnel says Chaga is saying is that we had very little opportunity to spread our Torah values and our love of wisdom to Arameans and Philistines and Edomites and Moabites. They weren't really ready to accept such a thing. The ancient pagan world was not on the Madrega to accept our Torah values. But a society that loves wisdom can be brought over. Right? A society that just wants to kol anosa nishomea, or you know, just steeped in a way of life that's so antithetical to Torah values is hardly going to be convinced to change their ways. But a society that cherishes wisdom, you have an opportunity to change them. But alas, because the Jews became so comfortable in Persia, and because the Jews did not return to Israel in the numbers that they should have, and Vayesheni did not reach its promise, like Yirmiyahu said in chapter 31, and it did not attract the people, like Yechezkel said in this week's Haftorah. So all of these opportunities that are mentioned earlier in Tanakh, none of them are absolute guarantees, right? The Tanakh often speaks in terms of what ought to be, not necessarily of what absolutely is, but what ought to be. Those ought to be. Okay, those ought to be happening, but you have to decide in what way it comes true, right? Okay, in some ways, some of these prophecies are coming true now. That's known as Shegaram HaChet, in Sota Daf Lamed Vav and in Brachas Daf Dalet. That prophecies that like Chagai or Yirmiyahu or Yechezkel speak are like transferred to a future time. Okay, so the Jews have become very passive, and these passive verbs continue until Esther takes control in chapter 4. Okay, so that is where there was a struggle between men and women in the first chapter, the Babylonian women and the Persian men, and Ahasuerus has to make this ridiculous decree about a law on the books about who's in charge of the household, and what happens in chapter 4 is we see two different approaches, Mordechai and Esther, in their approaches to how to deal with this decree. The reader can very well see that, I mean, every time we read the story, we know it from the year before, but if it's reading it the very first time, you can see that Esther is being put into a position that's going to be, convenient. We have someone on the inside, right? So here's what happens. Mordechai insists that Esther go right in and declare a plan. And Esther says, listen, I know some of the inner workings here. It doesn't work that way. And Rav Soloveitchik, in an article in his first, the first book written on his, from his shirim, is called Reflections of the Rav, back in the early 50s. And he says that men and women are programmed to deal with these things in different ways. Right? A man wants, when the man has to worry about b'zeyat ha'pecha tocha lechem, he's working on the nitty gritty, the engineering plan, to go right away. The woman, however, when she says be'etzev tel dibanim, she knows how to spend 9 months planning for something. He's got a plan for bread for tonight's meal, and she's got a plan for something. It doesn't mean that they can't think in ways that are you know, in addition to these ways, but that just the programming based on the roles Hashem gave them, and when they left Gan Eden, demonstrates how Mordechai and Esther plan this out. And Esther says, "No, we have to do more than what you're saying here. Let me think this over, and we'll discuss it." The question is, did Bnei Yisrael, they seem to heed what Mordechai and Esther want them to do, right? You know, it was sort of a hidden secret to Achashverosh what Esther's background was, but I assume that Jewish people knew that one of theirs was in the palace, and it's almost impossible to imagine that secret being kept. Now, imagine that, the whole Jewish people, not one of them felt like going to the palace and announcing to the king, "I have insider information for you." But whatever it is, she Achashverosh didn't know who Esther was until she told him, which is only 3 days from now, by the way, 4 days from now. Sorry, she fasts for 3 days, then has a party, she fasts for 3 days and asks the king for a party the next day and then the day afterwards. So it's the whole shebang is just a few days.
Oh, wait, this occur over Pesach?
Chazal say it did occur over Pesach, right? And when it says Vayavor, when Mordechai and Esther work out the fast, because it's like an aveira to fast during Pesach. Archaeologically, we see that the palace, the ancient Persian palace, was surrounded by a moat. So Vayavor could mean he passed over the bridge from the palace. Okay, but Esther's plot is to take advantage of Achashverosh's paranoia, which is born out of the very first pasuk, Hamolech Mehodu Ve'akush. And history bears this out. Maybe you've seen the Persian history book written from a Masoreti standpoint. It's called, it's by a man named Landy. Let me see, I have it in show. It's the excellent work, Perek by Perek, and he has one on Yirmiyahu too. And he does everything that is archaeologically available to us on this framework. And he agrees that Xerxes the first is Achashverosh. And the hint at the end that his name is spelled Ches Shin Re Shin, Ches Chashrash, Ches Shin Re Shin, just like that, missing a lot of letters. We pronounce it Achashverosh, it's a Kriyuk Siv. And that could be a hint that the Megillah wanted to tell us who this king is. And Esther is playing on his paranoia. Remember, a king who takes the throne from one person shouldn't be surprised if someone ever one day wants to take it from him, right? Now, he's not Stalin paranoid, because if he was Stalin paranoid, he would have killed Esther and Haman right away. But he is paranoid, right? To the extent that he can't sleep the night of the first party. So why can't he sleep? Well, maybe because he drank too much coffee in the evening, or many other reasons. But whenever, you know, the Megillah is actually written, and I say this in earnest, not only when it comes to mitzvahs, but when it comes to narrative as well. The Bible is written in a way that beckons us to partner with oral traditions about the story. Megillas Esther does not tell us why the king couldn't sleep, but there are hints to read between the lines for us to determine why he can't sleep. Okay?
Rabbi, is that Sada on Pasuk Dalet, where it says, Asher Asiti Lo? And Achashverosh doesn't know who she's referring to.
Yes. So here is the thing. This is her plan. She wants to plant it in Achashverosh's mind that it's possible that she and Haman have something going on. And, you know, in a chess game, the queen is the most important piece on the board. not the most powerful piece on the board, but the king, of course, is the most important piece on the board. And it may just very well be that, you know, like in Macbeth and in Hamlet, the queen controlling the queen controls the game, right? So is it possible, like he himself says at the end, Hakovish, what he really means is Hakovish es hamalchus imi babayis? Now, the Gemara that asks, how do we know that this book was written with prophecy? Where's the prophecy in this book? It's a nice story, but where's the prophecy? Remember what the Gemara's answer is? What's prophetic in this book? What could you know? What could you only know in this book if you were a prophet?
10 sons of Haman?
I don't know. Those are, it could be public record.
What Haman says in his heart, in his head.
That's what the Gemara says. How could the author know what Haman's thinking? Haman was thinking, who does the king want to honor more than me? Now, you know, that's fine, fair enough. But I would like to submit to you, and if anybody disagrees, please tell me, because I'd like to argue it out. I'd like to have a debate. If anybody, if it's not debated because everyone accepts it, you're also good. But I think that when Ahasuerus asked Haman that morning, tell me what I should do to give honors to a man that I would like to publicly honor, that Ahasuerus also knew that Haman was thinking that the king has me and Haman in mind. You agree? In other words, Ahasuerus was testing Haman. Why is Haman invited not to one, but to two parties with my wife?
With the crown. The difference is with the crown. Haman wanted the crown.
Yes. Yes. And when he mentions the crown, Ahasuerus, but he might have been, you know, checking on his emails at the time, but he, crown? Really? Right? So you know, to ride through the street on the king's horse with the king's raiment and the king's crown? What, are you crazy? So, you know, of course, Haman doesn't know that Ahasuerus is testing him, but also doesn't know that he's thinking of Mordechai. So Haman is so full of himself. Let me tell you, that same Gemara that started this year, Esther Minatar Minayim, asks, Haman Minatar Minayim. Do you all know that? Where is Haman in the Torah?
Hamin ha'etz.
Right. So it looks to in the text, it looks like Haman ha'etz asher tibisi levilti acham menu achalta. Right. Haman, the tree I told you not to eat from, you ate from. Mm-hmm. So it's a pun. It's mean as words. Haman set up a tree for someone else to swing from, and he's going to end up eating from that tree, if you know what I mean. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's the you know, that's the, but like the story about Anochi Aster Astir Panayim Mikem Hayom Hazeh is also has a deeper meaning here. You see, Adam and Chava had everything. They had everything in the garden, except one thing. So the snake is created by Adam and Chava, by their disobedience. Right? I'd like to say that in Parshas Chukas, when it says that the people were bitten by snakes, what did they have to do in order to stop getting bitten by snakes? They had to look up at this copper thing that was used later as an insignia for the medical field, right? They looked at this copper snake, and that'll cure them. You know, look, God is God. I'm not smarter than God, but God, wouldn't it just be easier for you to get rid of the snakes? Wouldn't it just take away the snakes? Right, bring in some mongooses or something and get rid of the snakes. And they have to do this. So the answer, I think, is, and it has to do with Haman in a minute, I'll show you, is that Hashem tells him, you know, human being, I can't get rid of the snakes. Only you can. I told you to listen to me in the garden, and you prefer to listen to the snake. You brought the snake into the world. You've got to do something to get it out. So I'm going to give you something to help you. You feel like you're doing the thing that gets rid of the snake. So in the garden, Adam and Chava had everything. And this is how the Yetzer Hara works. The snake starts telling them, you can't eat from any of these trees. What are you talking about? We can eat from every one except that one. That's how the Yetzer Hara works. It tries to convince you that you can't do it, so don't try. Don't even bother. Right? It tells you all the things you can't do before you can recognize what you can do. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden were behaving like Amnon and Shmuel Bet. Do you know what I mean?
They want what they want.
Like Woody Allen. It's Woody Allen. Remember him?
Yeah.
The heart has to have what the heart wants, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
So when you can have just about everything and you're raised that way, don't be surprised that that person is going to grow into a creature that wants what he shouldn't have. Nothing will do it for him except something that's that taboo, something that I know I shouldn't have. Right? It's almost a little like Shimshon also. But Shimshon, you know, any woman in Israel throw herself at your feet. So he has to want someone that's not doing that, someone that, a Philistine, right? So it's all right. That was a Tohanah Me'is Hashem. So I don't know if I can say that. But this is what's happening with Adam and Chav is they have everything, and what ruins it? The one thing that they shouldn't have. So too, Haman has everything. Haman, you have not only you have the king's ear. But the king only talks to you. You have replaced his whole inner circle. The queen, you have the queen's favor. You have so what made you lose your Garden of Eden? Because this one Jew refuses to bow to you? Look how much this man throws away because he wasn't satisfied with all that he had. Hamino eitz, ashut tzivisi. He's acting like Adam and Chava in the garden. Okay? All right, so Esther devises a plan to pique her husband's paranoia. And he says, you know what? There's no way that Esther and Haman could consider that they can get away with stabbing me to death at this party tomorrow. Because they would have to escape, and who's going to let them out of the palace? And then what's the point of killing me? So that the two of them can now rule? Who's going to go along with that? Maybe it's a conspiracy. Maybe there are people outside my door who have been plotting this for a long time and they have some pull with the army. You know, this is why he can't sleep. Because he's worried that if there was a plot on my life, I want to show that that person should step forward and inform me so that I can break the insurgency. And he's thinking, you know, I seem to recall someone did once tell me about an insurgency. And they go back to his diary and they say, yeah, it was Bigson and Seresh. Right? Right? It was big. So there's this beautiful Al-Sheikh that says he's called Big Sona Vaseresh. So some say it's Big Son Oseresh. It was just one of them. But I'm not going to get into that now. It's a little too complicated and there's not enough time left. So when he learned that there was someone who informed him of this plot and he said, did we do anything for that person? He said, no, we never paid him. No. Oh, whoa, okay. Tomorrow morning, I am going to make such a spectacle of that man who saved my life. And I'm going to get the word out that this is what we do to a man who I want to give kavod to. So that if someone, I know that Haman and Esther are trying to kill the king. Let me inform them in Mel. No, of course, that wasn't the case, but that was the point that Esther was playing with. Okay. Now, Haman was a Tzorei Yehuda. He's Tzorer HaYehudim. He was the head of this group that wanted to keep the Jews from rebuilding the temple. What better way to do that is to start by killing all the Jews here in Persia? The 127 kingdoms included Israel. Right? So this will get rid of the Jews and make sure that they don't show themselves to be like a fifth column and to have a favored status for their holy land. So the question is, when the story is over and the Jews are saved, then what? So this is a proof that, you know, no one can be loved by everybody. The last pasuk in Megillas Esther says that Mordechai was accepted by most of the Jews. It should say Mordechai was accepted by all the Jews. Let's say Rov Echav. Right? Now, there is a pshat to that answer, but Rov Echav, the Medrash said, the Gemara says in Megillah, Pirshu Mimenu Miktsa Sanhedrin, is that the rabbis were not happy about this. Sort of like I remember people not wanting to vote for Gore Lieberman on the possibility that they'll have a Jewish president soon. I don't know why. Every group, the Catholics get to have a president, the blacks get to have a president, but Jews don't want a Jewish president. No, stay away. Right? So that's what happened here, is that the Jews got so look, mi yodea im ka'es ka'es has la'es kazos, that there's a Jew in Ukraine. I don't know. Who knows? Stranger things have happened. But the Jews just felt, the Sanhedrin just felt, that the situation in Persia does not bode well for the situation in Israel. Alas, with Ezra, just about this time, because the story of Ezra taking Jews back to Israel is right about now. If we say that this is the same Achashverosh and Sefer Ezra that put a stop to the rebuilding. 1 in 100 Jews in the world at that time came back to Israel. 1 in 100.
But did Mordechai go back to Israel after all this?
It's a good question. Apparently not. Now, the Gemara says that Mordechai was Malachi, which is a bit of a stretch. It could fit historically, according to Landy, according to the opinion that has him later, right? It's a stretch, but especially since the first Targum in the book of Malachi, Masod V'Hashem El Yisrael B'Yad Malachi, it's the Torah Parshas Toldos, when it's not Macha Chodesh or Rosh Chodesh. So in Malachi, the first Targum says that Malachi was Ezra. That's more mistaber, because Malachi and Ezra are very similar themes between the two books. Be it as it may, it would appear that Mordechai just lived out his days as a prime minister or some kind of high official in Persia. Look, that has happened a few times in our history. Right? Rav Shmuel Hanogid was very, very high up in Spain. Rav Moshe of Kutzi, very high up in France for a short time. He saved the life of Richard the Lionheart in one of the Crusades, and he favored him with to become a governor of a province, and there have been some Jews who have risen to some degree of power, and Mordechai's position of power did not sit well with the Jews all around, because it did not bode well for the Jewish community of Israel that did not reach its promise. Zechariah has 13 visions describing the totality of Jewish history. This is according to Barbanel again, from the time of the Churban until the time of the Geula. And the 13th, Barbanel, he missed out by at least 500 plus years, says that the first vision has three horses chasing after a fourth, and the 13th vision has three horses chasing after a fourth. According to Abarbanel, the first vision is Alexander the Great giving up his kingdom to three. And the last vision is Columbus sailing to the New World with three ships. And Abarbanel felt that this voyage of Columbus to the New World would be a harbinger and would open up the gates to our redemption. He may be right. He seems to be right. The New World afforded the Jewish people a safe haven, relatively speaking, and an escape from the, still some of the horrors of the lasting Inquisition and the expulsion. So and the Inquisition followed them. The Inquisition followed them to Portugal, to Brazil, to the, you know, Jews at first went to South America. David de Solopoul, in a history book of this time period, claims that the reason why the center of commerce in the New World became North America more than South America, right? He says that there would have been the major stock exchange of the entire world would have been in Brazil, not in New York, if the Jews weren't forced out. Right? They went to Recife first, and then they were kicked out of there. So the Jews brought the center of commerce up north.
But it seems to me that Protestantism, actually, and Masons brought the Jews into the public life.
Could be, but the Jews definitely did make their way to the New World in significant numbers. It's not in the very beginning, but shortly afterwards. Look, Jews weren't allowed to. There was a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment even amongst the Puritans and the Pilgrims and Peter Stuyvesant. But there were still some elements that wanted Jews to be involved in these new endeavors in the New World, and the Bravanel considered it to be, based on the prophecies of Zecharia, to be harbinger of the future, this future Geula. And Zecharia says that the only way that this will happen is v'ha-emes v'ha-shalom ehavu. You shall embrace and love peace and truth. And that's what Megillas Esther, I think, makes a shout out to that when it talks about the book being divrei shalom v'emes. For Achashverosh, it's divrei shalom. We're not going to put our God in the story, but the Jews will know the emes. And that is the rest of the story.
Yeah. Okay. But if there is a lack of anti-Semites, the Jews themselves start to be anti-Semites. You see, in all these leftist movements, you see the heads or part of
yeah, that's very sad. I see that.
By all means, are Jews.
See that all around. Trevor, yeah. We'll go back to Shmuel Beis and Miyotz Hashem next week. Thank you so much for your indulgence this week and last week. I'm sorry I didn't have this in time for Megillas Esther, but here we are. We'll be back in Shmuel Beis to see David's reaction to the death of Avshalom, and tune in then. And we have Minchas Chinuch in about 10 minutes.